Hello everyone, and thank you for joining us for another recording for our series in the science of practicing medicine. Today we have Dr. Katie Rigstad, who's one of the surgeons in CentraCare, who focuses mostly on vascular surgery. Hello, Katie.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me.
Sure, thank you for joining us and for doing this. So your presentation has been one in the making. So finally, it will take place next month in November, and I'm very much looking forward to it because I think it's a very big topic. So could you tell us what you'll be talking about?
Yeah, so the title of my presentation is Atherosclerosis and Aneurysms. So not a very exciting title, but does really encompass much of what I do. So we'll be focusing on probably peripheral arterial disease will be the bulk of that talk, focusing on risk factors, kind of the general what to look for with these patients, and then also medical management, and then also some basics of surgical and endovascular procedures. There's been a lot of advances in this area. It's a very area of very active research over the past 10, 20 years. A lot of changes even since I finished fellowship just 7.5 years ago. So I think that will be helpful. Just knowing these can be very, oftentimes very nuanced patients to take care of and kind of determining the risks and benefits of procedures. And so just knowing what's available, I think will be helpful for people. And then also talking about triple A's, so abdominal aortic aneurysms and treatment options for those. And then finally, carotid artery disease with some advancements in that. Yeah, so it is a fairly broad topic, but definitely a lot of patients are affected by it.
Yes, and I don't know, I'm biased because I don't practice general medicine, but I think it's somewhat overlooked in a way, especially this never-ending dilemma of whether the patient has macro or microvascular disease and how to address in general. I think the big brother cardiac disease takes all the most of the attention. So I think the title is great, by the way. It sounds like a Grimm Brothers story, atherosclerosis and aneurysms, roaming free in the forest.
Yeah.
You know, without spoiling the presentation, but just as a teaser sort of thing, what's new in the world? And if you could frame it in what I would call medical prevention and then in surgical techniques, ballpark, what's new?
Yes. So with a medical intervention, not maybe not as dramatic advancement in that. Definitely, like statins have made a big improvement in medical outcomes of these diseases, particularly well with the cardiac outcomes and then also the carotid stenosis outcomes. But and then there are some new advances in medical treatment, like the NOACs, and but not as dramatic in the as the surgical procedures. So for peripheral arterial disease, just knowing about some of the advances in endovascular techniques, and then even anesthesia that patients oftentimes can do very well with these procedures, even if they're quite sick at baseline. But that being said, it's very nuanced in how you approach these patients and really what their goals of care are for that. For aneurysms, there have been quite a few advances in that too, as well for more of the complex aneurysms that are going up involving the renal arteries. And so that's something that's, I think, is good to be aware of, especially some of these patients. They are, again, I keep reiterating myself, but they are very sick patients, and and knowing how involved the procedure can be helpful in determining if they even will undergo a procedure or not. And then finally, for carotid artery disease, some different techniques for stent placement, which can be helpful in certain situations for patients. And then even medical management, if you have a stent versus if you don't.
Okay. Yeah. So, pardon my ignorance, but if I made a correlate, for example, in carotid, I'm sorry, in coronary disease, you know, we went from CABG to stent to now statins, and much of this now is medical care. If I ask you about statins in particular or medical management, have you seen also that while the surgical treatments are perhaps more advanced and less invasive, but the number of patients who end up needing that, have you seen that going down in proportion?
Not necessarily with the carotid disease, just because we do still see that there are pretty defined criteria that that would indicate if you should have intervention if you're symptomatic or if you are asymptomatic but have a severe degree of stenosis.
Okay.
But we do see definitely if for some reason people do not undergo surgical management with the statins and antiplatelet therapy, they do have much better outcomes either with or without surgery.
And that's for
That's for carotid artery disease.
Carotid. Okay.
Yeah.
So you don't see less people needing surgery in general.
Not necessarily for the carotids, and then for
Okay.
the peripheral arterial disease too. There are some like medical options for that that can be done. Mainly that is Playtol or Cilostazol, and that's more for claudication. But in general, once you get to the critical limb ischemia or more severe symptoms, then really in general, most of the time people are looking at revascularization. But the techniques of that have changed too.
So are the techniques for all these three? I think about, I don't know if it's wrong, but I think in three different spheres: carotid, abdominal aorta, and lower extremity vascular disease. Have the surgical techniques become less invasive with faster recovery?
Yeah. The surgical techniques are, so open surgery I define as any cut more than a puncture. They haven't necessarily changed much over the, like, since fellowship for sure for me, or even the last couple decades. But I do think it is much more like there is more of emphasis on good surgical technique. Patching, I guess, is one, like patching of any endarterectomy, either carotid or peripheral endarterectomy. Putting a patch on the artery so that doesn't restenose. That is a technique that is probably new in the last 10, 20, 30 years. So compared to longer ago. And then certainly shunting for carotid artery disease. I think there are a few techniques. Nothing in the last decade, I think, that has been a dramatic improvement. But certainly some of the medical management, like still like beta blockers, if they're on that, and then the antiplatelet therapy and statins. One thing even just that I really emphasize is continuing blood thinners throughout surgery. We will sometimes hold anticoagulation, not always, depending on the indication and what surgery we're doing, but I'll almost never hold Plavix or aspirin if they're on that, and that does definitely help with outcomes as well.
And I think it will need to be long-term mortality. Has there been, if you take decade after decade for the last 2, 3 decades, has there been an improvement in long-term care mortality or long-term mortality, I should say?
Yeah. No, I actually could not answer that. I'm not sure if there has been or not. I would have to look that up. I would say just anecdotally, the patients that we see are much sicker in a sense and have much more complex problems. Oftentimes on dialysis and have had, it's very common that they have diabetes, history, either CABG or stenting or both of those. And so I do almost think that there is an improvement in mortality because the patients that are seeing are in general older with more issues. And I think that's part of why the reason that we're seeing many of these patients in the past, they would have either died of a heart attack or died of end-stage renal disease or had their limb amputated. And in many cases, we're able to save their life. And then they go on to get, say, limb-threatening ischemia that you are able to salvage. And, but no, I would have to actually look that up, though.
Okay, so one question: is there one risk factor that you will put at the top of the list for all three of the spheres I mentioned, or each one has one that is higher? So, for example, I know tobacco is smoking is one for all of them, but for example, for peripheral vascular disease, lower extremity, is diabetes higher than tobacco? How would you rank them?
Yeah, I would probably put tobacco at number one for all three of those. For example, with peripheral arterial disease of the patients I see, it's I will sometimes see patients in their 40s or even 30s that have severe peripheral arterial disease with claudication or sometimes limb-threatening ischemia. So some of those patients are diabetics, and they have diabetics that tend to have severe like tibial and pedal disease. But of the ones with more proximal disease, there I have not seen one that has not been a heavy smoker. In their 30s or 40s. And then you get some in their 50s, 60s. Typically, they have some history of tobacco use. By the time they get to their 70s or 80s, it's sometimes tobacco, but sometimes just old age. Diabetes is definitely a big risk factor as well. And that tends to be more of the peripheral disease. But I would say of aneurysms, carotid artery disease, and peripheral disease, it's almost always tobacco. Only exception would be the if you want to separate out peripheral arterial disease and more proximal disease, like at the aortic and femoral level, that is more tobacco. Whereas peripheral arterial disease at the tibial and pedal level, that is definitely more common in diabetics. So probably, I'd say if I had to rank, I'd say tobacco, diabetes, and old age. Family history is certainly bad too.
Okay.
Yeah.
One subset of patients that we often share are diabetics with let's say, chronic wounds, etc., in the lower extremities. And I'm, of course, biased because I see them late, right? They already have a chronic osteo, etc. So I always wonder if somebody has, let's say, diabetes and or smoking and or hypertension, etc., and they have large vessel disease, I'm going to say peripheral disease.
Okay, yes.
I'm going to say, in my mind, almost always these patients also have small vessel disease, microvascular disease. So in what I see, I tend to see them fail because of the microvascular disease, which you cannot fix.
Yeah.
Am I right about that? Or you do see many patients that you do revascularization and they do well?
Yeah, with an infected wound?
No, in general. So if I ask you, what's the success rate for revascularization of lower extremities? Start with that.
Okay. Yeah, it depends on the situation. So before doing intervention, if we are going to be doing intervention, if you can get a CTA with runoffs, that's extremely helpful for planning a procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And after you get the CTA, you have a good idea if you're going to be successful with your procedure or not and what it's going to entail, whether, say, anything from a aorta bifemoral bypass, which is big deal procedure, big abdominal exposure, or some sort of major lower extremity bypass, versus maybe just a percutaneous stenting that they'll do very well with and high chance of success rate during the procedure. So yeah, it really, really depends on the situation. And then also too, in some cases, what the patient's tolerance is. For example, some patients, if they are older and healthier, they may say, I'll be willing to have an angiogram, but I don't want to have a bypass. And so it really just depends on the situation and how involved of a procedure they're willing to have and what the indications are. Probably claudication, we have a much better success rate
mm-hmm.
than, say, by the time you get to, if it's a person with a non-healing wound with osteomyelitis,
too
diabetes, late. I think that's the kind of success rate that can be much more difficult.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's so hard too for patients. And I tell patients, for example, if they need a toe amputation, there's always a chance that toe amputation won't heal. And you can kind of predict that based on what their arterial supply is, their comorbidities, and if they have any heart failure, that can come into play. I do tell them that if there's a chance it won't heal, and then may need to do, say, transmetatarsal amputation, below or above knee amputation, best chance of healing is if you do a hip disarticulation, but that's going to be unnecessary in most people. But so sometimes that we have some patients, they say, I just want to go with a below knee amputation because it has a better chance of healing than trying a transmetatarsal amputation, for example. And so it's kind of difficult too, like what success is, because it depends on somewhat of the patient's tolerance for a second procedure if that first one doesn't work. But yeah, definitely if they're diabetic with a big open wound, that can be more difficult.
So I guess asking the same question from a different perspective, intermittent claudication without wounds, etc., no chronic stigmata of arterial insufficiency, I guess that's a better prognosis. But this is based on what you see, right? I'm not asking you to tell me what data shows. But based on your experience, by the time somebody has, you know, very chronic changes in the legs, let alone an ulcer, etc., and they have macrovascular disease, do you think any of those patients does not have microvascular disease, or all of them, you would say, they also have microvascular disease?
If they have a chronic wound?
Mm-hmm.
That somewhat depends, too. They may not if they're more of a smoker and they have more proximal disease, like aortoiliac occlusion.
Interesting.
Like, for example, I had a patient yesterday and had rest pain with some early ischemic changes, reddening of the foot, and did revascularization of just the inflow, which is the aortic to the common femoral artery at the groin. And that took care of the problem and palpable pulses and doing very well. So it's not necessarily, I think if they have diabetes, it probably is a component of microvascular disease.
Okay.
Definitely see that with the wounds too, and pressure wounds and neuropathy, those all come into play too.
And I guess as the same as in the cardiac and brain vascular too, they do a lot of ramifications, so they have collateral circulation even if they have microvascular disease. So if you open proximally, they have a better chance even if they have microvascular disease.
Yeah.
And especially if they're used to having ischemia.
Yeah, some of the patients I haven't seen do well with revascularization of the large vessel disease, just that they're older and probably they have some component of heart failure and definitely some microvascular disease. And you can, improve the inflow to the point that they have good good pedal signals, but the wounds still don't heal. And I think in that case, it's just probably the microvascular disease, and probably the heart isn't pumping like it should. And a lot of things I'm sure we don't completely understand, but that can be a frustrating situation if you improve the blood flow, but it still doesn't heal.
I would like to switch you to logistics now. Could you briefly tell me what are the resources for vascular surgery within CentraCare, including you, St. Cloud, or what area you cover, who covers where, and what kind of team you work with, if you have, you know, a group of other providers that work with you or typically you refer to, and how do people send patients to you?
Well, I guess with referral of patients, it's just through the app. Typically, sometimes people will send me a message, but typically it's just putting a referral in.
The regular, yeah.
And if there is anything urgent, definitely just I tell people to contact me directly, either through Epic or cell phone, because if you call our clinic, you'll get told it's a month or two delay, but we can almost always get people in soon. And then even if I can't see them, or if they're St. Cloud, I can talk to my partners there and they can get people in typically pretty quickly. But there are three vascular surgeons in St. Cloud that are all very good. And then I work in Willmar, primarily just cover call there. And then I do outreach in Redwood Falls. I know Dr. LaVille, one of the vascular surgeons, he is starting new outreach now in Monticello. And okay. I don't think there's any other outreach going on with vascular surgery.
So it's Willmar, St. Cloud, Redwood, and Monticello.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I work with a dedicated nurses in Willmar. They're very helpful for doing some in-clinic procedures, more obviously minor procedures, not doing any PAD interventions there. And then a team, we have interventional radiology in Willmar. So that's that would be for endovascular procedures. Typically it's if it's percutaneous access, although we have done some very limited open procedures there. And then we have a operating room in Willmar, of course, we do open procedures. And then very often that we are doing hybrid procedures, which are both open and endovascular procedures at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a very common one would be a femoral endarterectomy, doing a cut down at the groin, and then doing stent grafting at the aortoiliac level. That's a very common pattern of disease people have. So that can oftentimes be done in Willmar. If it's going to be a more complex endovascular reconstruction, then I'll try to do that in St. Cloud if they have the timing. And of course, with all the shortages of everything, that can be difficult. And then if the patient can make the drive up to St. Cloud.
And will you be talking about when it's time to send a patient to you for any of the conditions that you'll be talking about?
Yeah, I probably will go through some of that. Main thing is if I think people do a pretty good job with referrals, but if they have any concern for peripheral arterial disease, and then also any symptoms that would be warrant intervention.
Thank you very much. And again, Dr. Katie Rigstad is one of the vascular surgeons in CentraCare. As mentioned, covers call also for general surgery, but mainly a vascular surgeon, who will be talking in November in the series, The Science of Practicing Medicine, about the topic atherosclerosis and aneurysm. So looking forward to seeing you there.
Okay. No, thank you.
Thank you.